Greetings, and welcome to Beatles Stuffology. We're two old friends sit around and talk BS, Beatles stuff, on a track-by-track basis, pretty much for the sake of it. My name is JG McCrory, and I'm here with my co-host, Andrew Deacon. Say hi, Andrew.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm actually reaching, and therefore sounding a little bit more strained than normal. And I'm reaching because I realise that just over to my left is a copy of Beatles 65, and I thought it might be useful while we're recording this episode to refer to Beatles 65.
Lovely. Well, just before we start the episode, which this week we are obviously going to be discussing Beatles for Sale as an album rather than going over individual songs, I do have to make one quick reference to an individual song. The individual song in question, unfortunately, is What You're Doing. Eagle-eyed listeners might notice that one has been curiously absent from our episode list. And that's my fault. I completely hold my hand up. I missed it. I was moving house. I don't know if that's a good enough excuse. It's the only one I've got.
I think you need to apologise to another song as well, though, don't you? Because What You're Doing's from With the Beatles.
Oh, God, I'm really all over
Every
the place.
Every Little Thing?
Every Little Thing. That's what I'm looking for.
That's the one you missed.
Ah, dear. Anyway, it's a whole thing. I'm aware that completists will now be struggling with the nightmare scenario of us not being able to cover absolutely every song. But anyway, listen, it's entirely my fault. I fucked it up. This episode is coming out after that episode, which posted last week. So that's the reason for it. I also have to say thank you to Guy Exley, who kindly sent us an email. He really got a hold of us and pointed it out, thus highlighting my tragic error. So thanks, guys, and sorry, everyone else.
So can I just clarify, we didn't put out the episode of Every Little Thing. So this episode is coming out after the episode of Every Little Thing, which is coming out after every other episode on the album. So Every Little Thing, which you've probably already listened to, is out of sequence, and we're now currently apologising for that.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just going to just assume I'm nodding along in agreement here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go. There we go. Well, that's podcasting for you. It's such a pacey, fast-moving environment that we didn't, and in fact we recorded our last episode and put it out on the same day because we were an episode down and we hadn't had time to get together and we didn't need to.
So, oh, the irony,
you know. So therefore, well, no, it's fine. We've punished ourselves, and by using the word we, I mean you punished yourself and forced yourself to do more work at a faster pace.
I'm just a mess at the moment.
Yeah, so anyway.
Dock my salary.
Beatles for Sale.
Yes.
Beatles for Sale. The album. We've done episodes before where we've talked about the albums having talked about each individual song. So we've got to the point now where we can talk about Beatles for Sale perhaps in context. Perhaps we can also go back and have a think of whether we've been too harsh about any of the songs, or whether we've undervalued any of the songs, whether it's an album that deserves to get the kicking that we have given it. I mean, it has a lot of defenders. There are people who rate it incredibly highly, and, you know, plenty of below the line comments on a couple of Beatles websites who think it's just a fantastic album, and that anyone who does not rate this album is not really a Beatles fan. And I think, okay, that's fine. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. And as regular listeners will be more than aware, I think that obviously a lot of people's responses to music is based upon emotional response rather than anything that's objective. I don't think music is something that we would tend to have an objective opinion of, much though we might like to think that our opinion is objective. So we need to think about this album in relation to the ones that have come before, maybe even in terms of where we're going next. And I think it would be wrong to assume that Beatles' progress is linear in terms of quality as well, because I think it's very rare that a band gets better and better and better and better with each release. I think it would be quite naive to assume that everybody's progress is, you know, constant. which is my way of saying we've regressed slightly from A Hard Day's Night. Not massively. I think the Beatles took huge leaps forward with Hard Day's Night, obviously in terms of the songwriting, and that's one critical factor why we've gone backwards slightly with Beatles for Sale. There's some decent Lennon McCartney songs on there, but on the other hand, there's not enough to flesh out an entire album, which is why we get concert material. Basically, we get songs that they know how to record quickly and put on a record because they're pressed for time between all of their various other commitments. And I don't think it's unfair to say that. I think it's just realistic of the schedule that they were following.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that comes across most clearly listening to this as an album rather than just listening to the songs is how tired some of this material sounds. Because I think there are a few moments on the album which show genuine spark and creativity, and I wouldn't want to say otherwise. And particularly the cover versions just sound like something that isn't necessary anymore. Not just because A Hard Day's Night was entirely Lennon McCartney, but just because there's so little enthusiasm in them. I think particularly on side two, if you listen to Honey Don't, it's such an inconsequential piece of work. And, you know, it's not really Ringo's fault, but there's nothing to it. In fact, Ringo's the only one who seems to be trying to sort of G it up a little bit. But it's just such a flat performance. There's nothing in it that like, if that song had just ended up as, you know, like an outtake that it got stuck in on Anthology 2 or something, like, you wouldn't be remotely surprised, because there's nothing in it that gives it that extra thing that sort of justifies its place in the album. But the fact it's then followed by Every Little Thing is amazing, because Every Little Thing sounds genuinely progressive, even without knowing where the Beatles' career is going to go. It just sounds like it's progress, or at least it's different from most of the material on the album. And like, you can hear how much more engaged everybody is in it. Ringo's got some lovely little dum-dum-tsh fills before the chorus starts. You've got the big timpani on the chorus itself. Like, there's a real effort to do something with that song. There's a couple of others as well. No Reply is much better sort of Lennon song than we've had probably anywhere else in this album. And there's a lot of opportunity to kind of see that the band can still reach forward, but there's just so much sort of cover version sludge here, and it doesn't feel necessary. And not only does it not feel necessary, but when we start having a look at the album charts, it becomes clear why it's just something that has to be left behind at this point. They have stalking horses now. It's not just the Beatles and then everybody else. There's real, genuine, contemporary challenge. And knocking out rock and roll music or God help us, Mr. Moonlight, just isn't going to cut the mustard.
Although they are contemporaries who haven't yet truly found their own voice.
No, that's true.
They're doing this, if only, you know, more so in terms of covers, and, you know, the likes of the Stones and the Kinks are still very much wedged to those bluesy covers as well. So they're developing their own voices, but they're still behind the Beatles, not just in the pecking order, but also in terms of the quality of original music. I think Every Little Thing is a useful one. It was written with a single release in mind originally, but you can tell that there's a lack of polish on it. As good as the song is, it doesn't quite have the same luster that they put into I Feel Fine, which was also recorded at this time along with other songs on the album. So there is that sense that they are improving in some areas, but there's still a way to go. And that's where it's a theme that's kind of come up in some of the recent episodes as well. And it feels rushed. And it doesn't just feel rushed in terms of the choice of songs, but also in terms of the quality of the production. And I don't think it's unfair to say that either. You know, we're existing at the moment in a in a realm where albums are recorded very, very quickly. It's not just the Beatles. You know, Dylan would be recording an album in very short space of time as well. We're used to now bands, artists taking their time recording, and I can remember back in I think the late 90s reading criticism of Stereo MC's album, and it was the one after their, you know, their massive hit, and what they were saying was that it took them longer to record the album than it took for the entire length of World War II. Well, some bands actually take an awful lot longer than that. I mean, some of us have been waiting for the latest World Party album for about 20 years now. It'd be quite nice. I've been doing a bit of a deep dive back into World Party and the Waterboys this week. It's been absolute heaven. Forgotten just how good, in particular, World Party albums actually were. But maybe that's for another day. But here it's a case of, you know, shall we? I'll use the word. I'm going to use the N word. Nascent recording industry. Just finding its feet, which is why we have in 1964 so few number one records in the album chart. There are relatively few high quality releases that compare with those of the Beatles. There are only four number one albums in the UK in 1964. Three of them are by the Beatles, and one is the Rolling Stones album. You know, it's just the way that the industry was at the time. And even though we get more in 65, it's still only a few number in 66. It's only then 67, 68 when, you know, truly the value of the album is seen by other record labels and other artists, and so much more time and effort gets invested. But who leads the way on that? Well, you know, the Beatles. Asterix, yes, I know, Beach Boys, Pet Sounds, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, the Beatles. So, you know, whatever we think about this album, and you know, I don't really think that much about it, it's still a heck of a lot better than albums by The Bachelors, for example.
Who are The Bachelors? I was looking at that in the album chart. I'm sure I've never heard of this band before. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Oh, I've heard of The Bachelors, but I couldn't honestly say I've ever listened to anything by The Bachelors, and I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with that too, and have not done so in research for this podcast, so if we're insulting any Bachelors fans out there, obviously I'm deeply sorry.
I want to say that Silence is Golden is their big hit.
Oh, God. But
if I'm plucking that from memory, it's from lots of trips in the car with Radio 2 on back in the days when Ken Bruce was probably in his 20s.
So World War One?
yeah, something like that. But anyway, okay. I could be... Oh, no, that's the Tremolos. Oh, there you go. Right, okay. Tremolos, Bachelors, those names all sound the same to me.
Exactly. However, I mean, I think what you say is true up to a point in terms of the rushing of the album. And sort of the industry standards of the time, I think we still have to kind of address this in a slightly, or criticize it really, in a slightly different way though, simply because the albums that we've covered so far, we've been able to say with some degree of confidence, I think, that there has been time and effort and thought put into the construction of the album. Whether that's the track listing, whether that's the cover art, whether that's the liner notes, whatever. This one feels that is less the case. And it feels sloppy by the standards of the albums that we've covered so far. Not the cover. The cover is fine. It's very autumnal. It's got the lovely sort of oranges and greens and all that. Everybody looks exhausted, as we know. That's fine. It very accurately reflects the content within. But the idea that there aren't that many great Lennon-McCartney songs on this, and they're sort of sprinkled through it in a way. But the fact that the album, we mentioned this when we were talking about the song, the fact that the album ends on Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby just feels like capitulation. It just feels, oh God, well, we've just given up at this stage. Like, that's a terrible way to close this album. I don't necessarily want to do the whole kind of, well, I'll just restructure the album because I know better than George Martin thing. But at the same time, like, you could end this album much, even if you flipped What You're Doing and Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, it would be a better end to the album. Because at least What You're Doing sounds, again, like it's some kind of progress. It's not just, oh, here's another rocker or here's another, you know, schmaltzy ballad. It feels like it has a degree of progressiveness about it in the same way that Every Little Thing does. And that kind of sloppiness just wouldn't really have been present on any of the other albums. The fact that it is here suggests to me that there isn't, we can't just use it was the 60s, man, as an excuse for the relative sloppiness of this presentation.
I've just noticed something. You're not going to like this.
Oh, God.
No. Well, you'll like the first part of it because it's me apologising. You are correct. You didn't put What You're Doing out, and that is from Beatles for Sale. I was mixing up with one that you forgot to put out from with the Beatles. Can't remember what that one is now, but that's lost in memory. So actually, we owe two episodes to the listeners.
Okay, that's
just
fine.
Just checking. We haven't put out What You're Doing and Every Little Thing.
Was I just drunk for a month or something?
So,
well, I suck at this.
That's actually really, really funny. So we put.
Oh, out, I'm glad you think so.
We missed Every Little Thing and we put out I Don't Want to Spoil the Party. Then we missed What You're Doing. And then we put out Everyone's Trying to Be My Baby. That's so funny.
Wow, I just, well, that's, there goes my thin veneer of professionalism.
Yeah, that's George Martin getting back at us for criticising his production.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm sorry, it's still not very good. No, that's not true. That's not true. The production is fine. It you know, but everything, it does sound rushed, and I do, I'm going to stick to my guns on this. I do think there's not that much evidence of, oh, maybe it's not fair to say there's not that much evidence of effort being made. Maybe it's just that the effort that's been made hasn't been as much as in previous occasions. Maybe that's a nicer way of saying it.
And there are examples of you know, cleverness with some of the intros and the outros.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, sort of really, you know, 8 Days a Week and Every Little Thing being, you know, good examples of those. You know, they're trying different genres as well. You know, so there are attempts at doing things slightly differently. You know, it's just not going to be an album that as many Beatles fans will return to. Ironically, I don't know if it's ironically, but there was still a huge demand for Beatles products because, according to Billboard magazine, 750,000 copies were sold in the first week. It is surprising to note, despite it being released in December 64, it is the biggest selling album of 1964. So there is demand. It is just so impressive how many people actually bought this, bearing in mind what we're saying. Now, of course, most people won't have heard more than a track or two that perhaps had been previewed, and we know that not a huge number of these songs were ever played live, but some were played for the likes of the BBC, and there's the odd TV episode around that time. So there is that element which is lost to us now, thanks to Spotify and you know, iTunes, and even if iTunes is still a thing, but all those other streaming services where you can at least preview songs before you decide which ones you're going to download, that people would be picking up a copy and trying to then work out, do I want this? Okay, well, you know, sounds like fun. Here's a bunch of song names. Okay, fine, it's the Beatles. I'll buy it. Be interesting to know quite how many then thought, But, you know, that's something that you can only really find by talking to lots of Beatles fans from the period.
Well, indeed. It's kind of interesting that sort of, you know, another thing lost to time, of course, is sides. Because the transition from Kansas City, to 8 Days a Week, listening to the album in a single stretch without that break, is actually surprisingly all right. It kind of works quite well. It's not one of the classics. I mean, the kind of the best example I can think of is sort of being for the benefit of Mr. Kite going into Within You Without You, is that is pretty seamless on a sideless playback. But it works surprisingly well. There are much bigger gear crunches in the album than the transition between side one and side two, particularly that I just can't get behind rock and roll music in this album. It's just not very good, especially when we have Kansas City, which is pretty great. And it's just that McCartney is better at doing that than Lennon is. But the crunch between that and I'll Follow the Sun just feels like it just doesn't work. It's a really kind of clunky transition. It's a funny thing. But again, maybe there isn't a really great song to transition out of that mediocre cover of rock and roll music. But it just speaks to that idea that like this could have been done a wee bit better. It's a strange thing. And you can hear so clearly listening to the album as a whole where those mistakes are being made.
Well, I think Kansas City would have actually made quite a good closer, bearing in mind the first two albums. But I don't mind that transition from Kansas City to 8 days a week. But I'm interested in getting your opinion on the track listing for Beatles 65, which contains 8 tracks from Beatles for Sale. Side one is mostly as per side one of Beatles for Sale, with the exception being There's No Kansas City, Hey Hey, Hey Hey. Side two misses 8 Days a Week and Words of Love. So you go straight from Our Friend and Yours, Mr. Moonlight, into Our Friend and Yours, Honey Don't.
Yikes. That's a whole stretch of nothing. It's kind of interesting, that track listing, yeah.
Well, you then, after Honey Don't, you then get a bit of a mix, because you've got I'll Be Back. Okay, right, very interesting. She's a Woman, I Feel Fine, and then you finish off with Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. So most of side two is just completely ignored. You get Honey Don't and you get Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, but you also get some, well, I Feel Fine. You get a single, you get a B-side, you get something from a previous album. It's a little bit higgledy-piggledy. However, it sold, and it sold in big numbers. But not only that, but then when this version was finally released 20 or 30 years later, sorry, when the Beatles for Sale original version was released, it sold a whole ton of copies in America. So, you know, EMI Capital didn't really know what they were doing, but they were able to not know what they were doing and still make a ton of money out of it.
Yeah.
Despite maybe because of their business sense and musical nous.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, business sense over everything else. I mean, that was the whole point of truncating the album, so that they had tracks left over that they could get more material to be released. Yeah, there's 5 songs on side two of Beatles 65. That's nothing. It feels really slight, even just looking at the track listing. But that, yeah, She's a Woman and I Feel Fine feel so weird, followed by Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, and on a side which opens with Honey Don't. Like, that's just like, it's interesting to the, you know, we've both sort of said Every Little Thing and What You're Doing kind of feels a bit more progressive or a bit more sort of forward looking than the rest of the album. They're both absent and they've been replaced with things which really are the future. You know, She's a Woman and I Feel Fine. It's just such a mishmash. I don't really know what to make of that track listing, other than, I don't know. Would I want I Feel Fine to be on Beatles for Sale? I don't know. I'm not really sure it fits thematically or sort of musically, but it is definitely, I mean, you know, it's from the same session, so there's obviously continuity there.
But then without that, side two just becomes nothing. Really,
yeah. Oh God, yeah.
You know, almost the best song on it becomes "She's a Woman," which is a really, really odd feeling. And yet, this edition of Billboard reports the fact that the Beatle 65 in a few weeks has scored over $1 million in sales. So there's pretty decent numbers. I Feel Fine was still a single in America, so it sort of breaks with that policy from the UK. That has sold, it's weird the way it reports it. It reports sales for Beatle 65 of $1 million, but that the single I Feel Fine in a month has sold 1 million copies. Doesn't mention the, you know, the dollar value. So it's an interesting thing. By the way, there is some really interesting language in this across a couple of articles. And I will admit I wasn't aware of this as a way in which what we have usually referred to as the British invasion of 64, 65, I suppose 66 as well, of acts going over to America and having success. But in two different articles, it's these beat sound, beat groups are referred to as redcoats.
Redcoats?
Redcoats, absolutely, which is utterly fascinating. I mean, this is in an industry paper, and they're using a term that is designed to mark them out as, well, I mean, the redcoats weren't, but they were, oh, let's not get into that. You know, they, yeah, I can, but right, let's not, no, just stop right there.
Yeah, stop right there.
You know, but that sense that they're an army coming to ruin everything that's American, and let's stand up against them. Now, in one of these articles, Dick Clark, who really famous broadcaster in America, he's rapping the British groups, and that's rap as in telling them off for basically being greedy, and talking about how he's losing money on the tours that he's promoting and other Americans are promoting because they're asking too much money and they're not very good. But then there's actually another article as well with Billy James, Columbia Records West Coast Manager of Information Services, refers to how poorly the redcoat invasion is doing in this country. And I think that's just so interesting. But he's then referring to sales. So, you know, Billboard Hot 100 chart lists 13 singles by British rock and roll acts. And that's a pretty substantial contribution. So, you know, he's saying that a lot of the criticism from the likes of Dick Clark is just utter nonsense. But we're still using the term redcoat, the redcoat rhubarb, it says in the headline. The subheading, by the way, on the Dick Clark article, the heading is Dick Clark raps Brits. But the subheading is, I think, even more hilarious, because he refers to it. Sorry, it. The sub-editor has put greed, puffs cited.
Well, that's an interesting sentence.
Which, I mean, I'm trying to work out if that means that the British redcoats are puffs, powder puffs, or puff as in it's just a puff of smoke. Anyway, yeah, really, really, really interesting that they're kind of going against the general feeling. But there we go, America, snowflakes.
Well, it is interesting, I think, from a cultural perspective, to see the way that the band was seen contemporaneously. I mean, we've often commented on the podcast that, you know, that obviously, you know, this is the big breakthrough moment culturally for the 60s. But it is also the first time, you know, American pop cultural hegemony is being challenged in any way. You know, you can look back to Frank Sinatra, you can look back to Elvis, you can look back to the initial burst of rock and roll music with Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis and all that. It's all 100% American. You know, the first, I think it was Telstar, was the first British single to get to number one in America. I mean, it's decent enough single, but it's no Elvis challenger, I think it's fair to say. And that cultural hegemony has persisted basically from the end of the Second World War, whether it's in pop music, whether it's in movies. TV shows are still sort of fairly divided. There's not yet a lot of cross-pollination between the US and the UK in terms of TV, but certainly musically America has always led the way. We were talking about the album charts before. You know, the week that Beatles for Sale went for number one, West Side Story is still in there. West Side Story is an amazing album in terms of its sales. It will continue to sell absolute shed loads. And it also obviously, you know, comes from that same sort of cultural, I'm trying to not use the word hegemony again, that same cultural background that has produced these kind of very globally dominant forms of music. It's kind of genuinely fascinating to see how threatened, how fragile that kind of position really is, because those kind of comments from somebody like Dick Clark, that's not a small name, that's somebody who's like a serious industry player. Like they have had this kind of cultural domination for what is essentially 20 odd years and more. And this is the first time anything has come close to cracking it, and suddenly they're kind of throwing a hissy fit. Oh, how could they come over here and be greedy? Yeah, like Colonel Tom never fell into that trap, thank goodness. You know, it's such a weirdly fragile position for them to be in, and also weirdly hypocritical. But that's, yeah, I guess, suppose that's the industry then at that time.
I'm just making a note to write to the representatives of Lonnie Donegan, Tommy Steele, Joe Brown and the Brothers, Adam Faith, The Shadows and Cliff Richard, to get them to listen to this episode where you've basically said that their careers amounted to nothing because of the American hegemony in rock music.
I am talking specifically about British art acts charting in America. I do want to make that very clear. Also, Cliff Richard and the Shadows can go fuck themselves. Anyway, please do carry on.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a particular fan of those. And in fact, listening to
nothing wrong with Lonnie Donegan,
you know, the Big Beatles Sort Out latest series as well. Hi guys, if you're listening, are you listening? Are you? Okay. They sort of make the point there's quite a few British acts who make the number one who are basically half decent looking bloke in a suit given a song to sing. You know, that's very much the nature of the recording industry at the moment. It's probably not that dissimilar in a lot of American recording companies as well, which is why, wait for it, which is why the Beatles are so different. Not just that they are a group, unlike most of those acts previously mentioned, but that they're doing it for themselves. That they, although under the auspices of a record company and of a producer who is still having a big influence on what is being recorded and what's being released and in the order it's being released, but is working with them and understands the fact that they are incredibly talented and incredibly charismatic, and they are developing a trajectory. So I think the Beatles are a particularly unique set of circumstances that they either were absolutely in the right place at the right time, or they were the catalyst to shake up an entire industry that desperately needed shaking up. They're certainly doing it, and obviously Dylan's doing it in America, and they're opening the door for so many other acts to come through. So whatever we think of Beatles for Sale, it really has such a huge impact. Just imagine 750,000 copies being sold in a week. Well, no wonder record companies might start to look at that and go, there's a market there. Let's start to fill it with our amazing acts, because it is starting. I mean, you referred to the fact that there were, you know, other bands coming through, but let's not overplay the hand there. Yeah, okay. So in the top 10 in mid December, you've got Roy Orbison steadily climbing the charts at number 8. You've got the Kinks at number 9, just on the way down, been in the chart for about 3 months. You've got the Animals as well. Again, they've been in the chart for a couple of months, just steadily dropping down. But just outside the top 10, you have West Side Story. It's been around for 145 weeks. Also in the top 10 that week, you've got Val Doonican. You've got, and this says everything about who is buying a lot of albums at this time. You've got the George Mitchell Minstrels. I'm pretty sure they came up in a previous episode of
where
we talked about albums. Yeah, they sell tons of albums in the 60s, and it is an act that just could not exist anymore. We are talking about Black and White Minstrels act selling tons of records alongside, you know, smooth crooner Val Doonican, alongside Jim Reeves's 12 Songs of Christmas, The Bachelors and 16 Great Songs. You know, this is, there are elements that you might regard as cutting edge, but there's elements that actually the record buying public still contains an awful lot of adults who are buying things that are very much regarded as being easy listening. Jim Reeves has got 3 or 4 entries in this top 20. Frank Ifield's still kicking around with an album, and we know that he's someone who's got completely usurped by the Beatles. There's still a market for them. So, you know, I think it's important that we remember that there are lots of different people buying albums. Young people might be veering towards the kind of bands, you know, like the Stones and the Kinks and the Animals, that's fine. And the Beatles, although the Beatles do tend to cross over into a lot more genres, partly because of their choice of songs. You know, there's Here's One for the Mums, here's one for the, you know, yeah, here's one that the old show tune type thing that they used to do as well. So, you know, broadening their audience very cleverly. But there's a lot of people, shall we say adults, young adults, maybe even if you want to venture into sort of middle class people buying original soundtracks of Camelot and West Side Story, they're buying different records. And that's okay. That's okay. The charts represent what's being sold. And in this case, there isn't a dominant musical hegemony to be seen. Although actually, come to think of it, I mean, you sort of trawl through that. It's predominantly British. Oh, Frank Ifield's Australian, I think, isn't he? And Jim Reeves, American. Manfred Mann, for example, although, wasn't the lead guy in that South African? Anyway, they're regarded as a British band. You know, you've got the Supremes, but the Beatles, the Stones, the Beatles are in twice, so Stones, Animals, the Kinks. You know, the British Invasion is doing pretty well. The Redcoats on home turf are definitely ahead of the game. Roy Orbison can have a couple of, you know, albums in there, but, you know, the only albums on this chart that have reached number ones are Hard Day's Night, Beatles for Sale, the Rolling Stones album, and West Side Story. Nothing else has hit number one. They sell good amounts, but not as much as those. And I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's one of the most interesting things about, I think, the 60s in terms of the way that music develops is that, you know, for all that there was so much of a revolutionary change in the... By the way, are we adding hegemony to Beatles Stuffology Bingo? I think we might have to.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think the amount of times you've said it today, and I know I've chucked in a couple, but that's more in pastiche.
One of the most interesting things about the 60s as they develop is how revolutionary they are and yet how conservative they remain as well. There's a genuine tension there. The chart that you were talking about was the first week that the Beatles for Sale got to number one. If you look at the last week that Beatles for Sale was in number one, which is 9th of May to 15th of May 1965, it fell down, came back, fell down, came back. Bob Dylan has 5 albums in the top 20. The Kinks are there. Yeah, Val Dunigan's hanging in there. Elvis is there. And Cliff. Oh, and Joan Baez at number 20. But we also have Mary Poppins' original soundtrack, The Sound of Music original soundtrack, and My Fair Lady soundtrack. So we see exactly the same thing, even when the Stones are in there at number 3 with their second album. But it's exactly the same thing. Like, for all that these are artists that we regard as, you know, far, far higher up the quality chain in terms of the Kinks, the Stones, Dylan, and the Beatles, all that other stuff is still there. It's still selling. But it's interesting to see that the shift is there.
This isn't just true of the 60s, though.
You know, no, of course not.
The myth, of course, is that at the 70s, that, you know, it was either prog rock or punk. And actually, there's an awful lot of very middle-of-the-road pop. If you watch some of these old showings of Top of the Pops from the 70s and the 80s on BBC 4 on a Friday night, you'll find, I mean, I sort of remember the very late 70s and then the early 80s as being just an absolute wonderful time for amazing music. And yet that's not represented on the charts. You know, all I can think of now from sort of like the mid to late 70s is Brotherhood of Man, Save All Your Kisses for Me. And I think it's entirely representative of what sold. There were lots of those, you know, pop songs that just feel so dated. But then people will look back in 20 years' time at what's selling now, and possibly they'll still be able to find some similar examples as well. So I think it's something that we run the risk of perhaps sort of pigeonholing the 60s, saying, well, actually, the music industry is aware of the fact that it is selling to a vast range of people, and it produces things to appeal to that vast range of people. And cultural commentators run the risk of overemphasizing the significance of a particular style, a particular genre, over something else. Punk did not sell in huge numbers, for example. You know, its legacy was more significant afterwards. It's a little bit like the you know, those bands like the Velvet Underground, who had a much greater impact on people who then sold records than they did in terms of record sales for themselves. So an awful lot of people were inspired by punk, who then went on. And in fact, I was listening to an Adam Buxton podcast this morning with Fred Armisen. It's one of the relatively recent ones. And Adam, they ended up talking about Haircut 100, bizarrely. Adam Buxton was talking about the fact that, I didn't realise this, they started out as a punk band who then moved into that sort of more glitzy pop, you know. And I can see that, can absolutely see how they might have got started because of something that they found to be so different and so accessible. Just like an awful lot of bands will have got started because of what they saw the likes of the Beatles doing. They would have seen, you know, what they were trying to do. And there will be an awful lot of imitators that we'll probably talk about over the next couple of years.
The whole Merseybeat scene is precisely that. The whole Merseybeat scene is basically an entire industry dedicated to trying to do the same thing that the Beatles does, but less well. And I definitely think you're right about the way that cultural commentators will emphasize stuff, and often, you know, stuff that will make them look better in reflection, as it were. Because, of course, the dominant musical form of the 1970s was disco. It's not prog, it's not punk, it's not AOR, it's disco. Disco is the prominent musical form, but it's also the one which has the least credibility if you're talking about kind of musical influences or musical development. And, you know, for a long time, you couldn't talk about disco at all without simply being sneered at. Now, some of that might be justified, some of that might not be justified, but ultimately, if you want to talk about the story of the 70s, you can't not talk about disco. That's the biggest selling musical form of the period, and not by a small margin, by an absolutely massive margin. It's the same in the 60s. The Beatles are the biggest selling artist by an absolute country mile. Of course they are. But, you know, Ken Dodd had the third biggest selling single of the 60s. nobody is probably doing a deep dive into every single track that Ken Dodd ever recorded. Although maybe there's a podcast out there for everyone, right? So maybe I'm misspeaking, and if I'm insulting any Ken Dodd podcasters, I do profusely apologize.
Was it one of the best regarded singles of the early 1980s was Ultravox's Vienna, which was kept off number one by the smash hit that was
Shut Up Your Face.
There you go. Which was
by Joel Dolce.
Yeah, Joel Dolce loved it. Absolutely loved it. Part of me thinks we're recording this on the 24th of February, and assuming JG remembers to put it out, you'll probably hear it at some point in late March. This has been the week in which the new Beatles films, directed by Sam Mendes, have been released. Part of me hopes that one of them...
have been announced, not released.
Have been announced. Apologies. Yes. I'm just getting so excited about it. part of me hopes that one of them takes a look into a what might have been scenario in which the Beatles stayed together and it was them that produced the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever, not the Bee Gees, and what that would have sounded like. I think a Beatles disco album. There's something for AI to conjure up.
Well, your Ringo did a disco album, didn't he?
Quite possibly. I mean, I think that there's a whole load of the Beatles singles, Beatles solo recordings in the 70s that are not just a grey area for me, but a complete void. And I'm quite happy to admit that.
I don't think you're missing much there. I don't know. Just out of curiosity, what are your feelings about the movie? I mean, I know because I can see you and I saw your face when you were talking about them. But for the sake of our listeners.
On the one hand, thank God it's not Peter Jackson. But on the other hand, they could have closed the loop and had a fantasy in which finally the Beatles were being portrayed in the film as hobbits in the Lord of the Rings film that got talked about but never made, and that Peter Jackson therefore directed a new version of Lord of the Rings with people playing the Beatles playing the hobbits. I think that would have been fun. I don't care. I genuinely don't care. I think it's another truly stunning piece of marketing that is designed to keep the Beatles' name alive and also to then project it for a new generation. I hope that some people have been talking about how they could do a Rashomon type thing and look at the Beatles story from four different points of view. I maybe hope I think four different directors would have been better to take a different kind of approach to it. If they're going to do something that's linear, well, hopefully then they'll do, I don't know, the first part of the Beatles story from John's point of view. Then perhaps Ringo, as he's involved, gets involved with the band takes off. Oh, you know, look at me joining the group. And then maybe Paul, as he becomes the more dominant player. And then George, perhaps for the last part where, you know, he's growing in stature and then outgrows the band enough to be able to produce the one truly phenomenally legendary Beatles solo album. But that would be okay. But yeah, you know, do we need them? No. Are there going to be plenty of people who will lap it up because it's new Beatles content? Yeah, but they're also the kind of people who are now spending tons of money on vinyl re-releases of albums they've already got. Good. If that's what they want, that's great. What's your view?
I think it's an interesting proposition that isn't necessary. I think that's kind of what it comes down to. Especially if it is, if it is the story from each of the four members' perspectives. I think that's an interesting idea, and if the films sort of interweave across each other, that's kind of interesting as well. But I don't think it's something that's... Actually, I kind of agree with what you said. I think it'd be much more interesting if there were four directors, if you had a different directorial style, maybe a different way of putting the... the material together. The only example I'm thinking of what I mean is a really, really bad example. But you know the REM thing, tour film, where like each song is like sometimes it's Super 8, sometimes it's just straight on stage, sometimes it's like that kind of thing, like that kind of like different way of presenting the material. I think having one director across all four movies is likely to not be the most successful approach. And I'm just dreading how the casting is going to be.
That's the other problem, isn't it? That you're going to end up with conversations about the casting, you know, which a Beatle does Timothy Chalamet look the most like and which one could he play?
God, please.
You know, it's going to happen. Ian Hart's too old to play John Lennon these days, so that's not going to work. Because there was a time where it was impossible to have anything about the Beatles without Ian Hart as John Lennon, very good as he was. I think they should get David Lynch to do the one about John Lennon. I think that would be
excellent.
Suitably appropriate. But let's face it, that's never going to happen. The other problem, of course, is that these are officially sanctioned, officially approved, and that makes me think that rough edges will be smoothed.
Yeah, it's going to be the party line.
Yeah, and Sam Mendes is perfect for Paul McCartney. I think it feels absolutely the right choice. He's a very good, very accomplished director. But is there going to be enough of an edge to it? Even if there is, am I going to go and see them? I don't know. I don't know.
Although, it's an interesting one. Yeah, I probably will see them, but I might end up seeing them when they're on streaming services or, you know. Obviously, this podcast doesn't want to suggest the cool crime of piracy is in any way appropriate, but other methods of viewing things do exist. Will I go and see them in the cinema? I don't know. I'm very. It's a lot of movie. That's a lot of movie for. I don't know. Maybe if it gets rave reviews across the board and Oscar nominations.
I don't know. The thing is, I don't go to the cinema on my own anymore. We always go with the other half. It's a social thing. You know, something you talk about beforehand, you go watch together, talk about afterwards, you know, and so you then kind of also there's that sense of, well, what should we go and see? There's an element of compromise. I mean, I can only think of two occasions in the last, I don't know, like 10 years or so where I've been to the cinema on my own, and those were occasions in which she was away for, you know, reasons, visiting, you know, friends, family, and what have you. And I seem to recall that the Armando Iannucci directed version of David Copperfield, one that I saw, and there was a really moody, intense version of Macbeth that came out about 6 or 7 years ago as well. Don't remember why I went to see that one. I don't know. Is it the kind of film I would go see on my own? Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, I'll leave you to decide how much of this tantalising conversation you're going to leave in the podcast.
all of it, every last riveting second.
Which bits you're going to edit out, because let's face it, no one's listening at this stage, are they?
Sorry what?
Oh dear. If you're still listening, let us know, because we've been going for about 45 minutes and it feels a lot longer.
We might have drifted slightly off topic. I think it's possible.
Yeah, so the album's fine. It's fine. You know, it's a good album in context. It's not a great Beatles album. Perfectly fine to say that, isn't it?
I think it probably is.
A theme. Yeah. And it's a good job we don't rate the albums, or do we?
Yes, we do.
Bugger. Right, okay.
Get to it, mister.
Five. It's five. It's a Beatles 5 out of 10.
Five out of ten.
I think that's only fair because at some point there's got to be a 10 out of 10. And that could, for example, be Revolver. It could be Sgt. Pepper. But then, White Album. Abbey Road. Rubber Soul. You know, you sort of get the point that there's got to be enough of a gap between Beatles for Sale and whatever's going to end up being a 10 out of 10 album.
Fair enough. For context, you gave Please Please Me a 5, With the Beatles a 6, and A Hard Day's Night a 7.
Well, and then I think I'm definitely correct in saying that this is a 4 out of 10 album, and I'm not going to change my mind on that.
Okay, fair enough. Will. 4 out of 10. All right, that's interesting. I think I will give this 5.5. It's fine. I do like it. I just wish I liked it more. It's such a hard album to get motivated about. Honestly, this isn't that, obviously this is now the fourth album we've spoken about. I think we've struggled conversationally more with this album than the others, and I think there's a good reason for that. There's a lack here, and you know, it's just hard to get that worked up about. It's not awful. It is better than most other things around at the time, but it's still, there's just not a lot of there.
That's fair enough, and it was probably the last Beatles album I got to in the 80s as well, so I think there was a reason for that. I wasn't necessarily rushing with great excitement at the thought of an album that contained so many cover versions, whereas Please Please Me and With the Beatles, because they were the first albums, you could then sort of view them as a band that were growing. But here we've got a band that has taken, you know, at best a sidestep, which is why I think we view it in the way that we do. And, you know, that's fine. But I think the people who really like the album seem to be people who listen to it contemporaneously. But then, you know, emotional response. Insert that on your bingo card.
Lovely. My bingo card is chock full. Right, lovely. Well, I think we can probably leave Beatles for Sale there. As we trust you know, and if you don't, well, you're probably not going to find out because I imagine the number of people who have listened this far are not high. But anyway, as we hope you know, you can really get a hold of us. You can contact us by email, and it's nice to see that a few people have been, so thank you very much for that, even if they are pointing out my mistakes. We are BeatlesStuffology@gmail.com. We're on whatever is left of Twitter at Beatles_ology, and we are BeatlesStuffology on Instagram. You can find my blog at www.jgmacquarie.scott, and you can check out my other podcast as well, which is Talking Trek to You, where a noob and an expert go through the original Star Trek series episode by episode. Please like, rate, and review us on whatever podcatcher you're using so that more people can find the show. Next episode, we move into the singles market, and it's time to talk about Ticket to Ride. But until then, keep listening.